protesters in Bahrain gathered outside the newly opened Israeli embassy in Manama to denounce normalization with Tel Aviv. People in France hold nationwide protests to express anger at their living conditions, including stagnation of salaries and the cost of living. Facebook takes another pounding when a former employee and whistleblower accuses it of promoting human trafficking and domestic servitude, among other things. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. People in Bahrain have taken to the streets for the fifth straight night to denounce the opening of the Israeli embassy in the capital, Manama. Demonstrators gathered outside the newly opened Israeli embassy. They chanted the slogans to slam the opening. No incidents was reported. Previous protests turned violent as security forces attacked the demonstrators to disperse them. Israel opened its embassy in Manama last Thursday during a visit by Foreign Minister Yair Lapid. Bahrain is one of the four Arab states that normalized relations with Israel last year under a U.S. broker deal. Main opposition group Al-Wafaq and top cleric Sheikh Isa Qassem have both condemned the normalization. Palestinians have called it a stab in their back. Political commentator Saeed Chahabi says the Bahraini regime has become more unpopular among the people following the opening of the Israeli embassy in Manama.
We have always been, in the last 10 years, I don't think there was a single day when there was no protest against the regime. It is dictatorship, but now it has committed treason, not only against Bahrainis, but against the Bahrainis, the Arabs, the Muslims, the humans, human beings. This is number one. Number two, this time the regime has gone a step further by allowing the Israelis to share, getting the information on native Bahrainis. The statistics offices have been open to the intelligence services of Israel, and now my personal information is readily available to the Israelis. So, and this is number two. Number three, the regime is also cooperating and asking the Israelis to support them in terms of security and targeting their opponents. And this is a very serious development. The Bahrainis, especially outside the country and in jail, inside jails, are really worried about what the Israelis are going to do, because the Khalifis have authorized and asked and requested the help of the Israelis to undertake these actions. So all in all, the situation is very grim, it's very bad for Palestinians, for Bahrainis, for the security of the region, for the human decency in our world.
Six Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue their hunger strike to protest their administrative detention. Two of them have been transferred to the hospital over their deteriorating condition. Our correspondent Mona Kendall has a report.
The hunger strike of six Palestinian prisoners who have refused to eat for days have once again brought the plight of Palestinian prisoners to attention. The six are on hunger strike to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them.
Israeli prison authorities refused to deal with the hunger strikers' legal demands. Kaid Al-Fosfos has been on a hunger strike for over 82 days. Mehdad Al-Gawasmi for over 76 days, and both were transferred to Goplan Hospital. Ala Al-Araj as well has been transferred to Al-Ramlis Clinic. Their health condition is deteriorating, but they insist to continue with their move to end their illegal detention.
In solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah. Here, every week, you'll see prisoners' mothers and wives holding the pictures of their beloved ones. They say they are the voice of the prisoners.
My son Mujahid went on a hunger strike and ended it after the Israeli authorities decided not to renew his administrative detention and to release him. Mujahid spent almost 10 years in jail, and then he was rearrested after 15 months of release. His administrative detention has been renewed 3 times. That's why he started the open-ended hunger strike. I know he was risking his life, but that was only for the hope that he could be released to live with us, his family, and to raise his only child.
Administrative detention is illegal, however. It's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with 520 of them under the illegal administrative detention. Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoner follows the same path in the future. Unfortunately, Israel ends the administrative detention only when hunger striking prisoners are on the verge of death. Mona Kandil, Occupy Jomallah.
A popular professor at Bristol University in England has been fired following the relentless campaign of complaints by pro-Israel groups. Professor David Miller was a well-known expert on propaganda and lobbying. His recent works, though, exposing Israel lobby activities in Britain, has made him some powerful enemies. Robert Carter spoke to Miller following his shock expulsion.
A British university in the town of Bristol caused uproar after sacking a pro-Palestine professor following a sustained campaign by pro-Israel groups. An academic expert in propaganda and political pressure groups, Professor David Miller is a known critic of Zionism and the Israel lobby.
I've been working for decades in higher education in this country, and I never thought that making political comments at an external political meeting while I wasn't at work could possibly result in me losing my job. I'm just kind of a bit shocked by that.
In the past, Bristol University has admitted that Mr. Miller's anti-Israel remarks did not constitute unlawful speech. However, their latest statement on the sacking said Miller's conduct did not meet the standards of behaviour we expect from our staff. The sacking was in response to 2 lectures the professor gave linking Zionism to a rise in Islamophobia. The complaints were reportedly published by the Community Security Trust, Board of Deputies of British Jews, Jewish Leadership Council, Union of Jewish Students, among others, all staunch supporters of Israel. Following this, Miller said the university's decision was designed to send a chill down the spines of academics around the world who expose Zionist racism.
There is a campaign led by the Israeli government through pro-Israel groups in this country and indeed in other countries to silence all of those who would in any way support Palestinian rights. And that campaign will not stop with me, and they will feel that they have gained a great victory in having me sacked, and they will redouble their efforts to have other people sacked. So unless and until people realise that that's what's happening and they turn their attention away from the specific comments I might have made, which were themselves anti-racist, not racist, and to the attention to the originating force behind this, which is the Israeli government, then people will be vulnerable to being sacked for making perfectly reasonable, lawful anti-racist comments.
Onlookers are very fearful about what this could mean for debate going forward, and not just related to the Palestine-Israel conflict, but related to freedom of speech in general. Ultimately, if you say the wrong thing on certain topics, it could mean that you are sacked from universities, which historically were a place where freedom of speech reigned supreme and was protected. Robert Carter, Bristol.
Distribution of Iranian fuel has begun in Lebanon, despite objection from the United States. Experts argue that the move is more than just fuel provision for the Mediterranean country. Mariam Saleh has more.
With the second shipment of Iranian fuel already making its way to most Lebanese areas, the electricity crisis has somewhat been lifted. Private generators and companies have welcomed the initiative by Hezbollah to bring in Iranian fuel through Syria.
We are buying diesel oil for a lower price. We are also buying it in Lebanese lira, and this fuel is for all sects and all religions.
Despite some criticism from foes of Hezbollah, The general response has seen the fuel as a form of humanitarian aid.
Lebanon's need for this fuel and the method with which Hezbollah distributed the fuel to all sectors and all factions in Lebanon has helped to strengthen the Lebanese society and its sovereignty. Hezbollah had been very careful not to negatively impact Lebanon in any way when it came to security and maintaining the unity of Lebanon, which is our priority. And so it was a very significant backup for Lebanon when it needed it the most.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed previously that a bigger portion of this fuel will be distributed as donations. This is one of the major petroleum stations in Lebanon, which was affected by the crisis. Today, it is the main distributor of Iranian fuel in the country. Several Al-Amana stations across Lebanon are responsible for the distribution of gas, either free or selling with a price cheaper than the market. Experts believe there's more to the import of fuel from Iran than meets the eye.
This convoy of ships has proven that at any time when the Americans exit the region, there can be an alternative. And this alternative is not only military and political, it is also economic. And this is the upcoming challenge for our country and our communities. Even the U.S. and its agents have understood that the issue is not merely an issue of providing fuel, but that there is an alternative lead by the Islamic Republic of Iran in alliance and cooperation with all the countries in the region to free its economies instead of being under the U.S. hegemony.
Hezbollah has also noted that this initiative will not cover all hours of electricity, but that there needs to be reforms in the electricity sector, while some of the gasoline shortage should be met with the arrival of a third Iranian ship. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
In other news, the European Union is preparing steps to mount pressure on Britain to make it abide by the deals it signed after leaving the bloc. French European Affairs Minister Clément Beaune says that the measures will be announced within days. He did not specify those measures, but said that they aim to defend the interests of European states. Beaune pointed to Britain's recent fuel crisis, implying that one of those measures could be related to the UK's dependence on European energy supplies. The EU and UK have been working on trade deals since London left the bloc in February 2020. Many issues remain unresolved as the UK is pushing to secure its own demands. Researcher and economist David Hearn says the main issue between the UK and the EU is related to the Northern Ireland Protocol, agreed as part of the Brexit deal.
I think there are two main issues outstanding at the moment. There's an ongoing and quite serious disagreement, shall we say, over certain elements with regard to Northern Ireland. That, I think, will continue to bubble away and will come to a head towards the end of the year. The second issue is as regards the access of French fishing vessels in particular to certain parts of UK territorial waters. So the biggest issue is mostly related to the Channel Islands around Jersey, but there are also some issues with regard to access to the UK coastline. Ultimately, I think from my perspective, I see that as less serious. I mean, obviously, that's not a position that would be shared by Clément Beaune, but we are ultimately talking about a handful, 100-ish fishing permits in total.
The people in France have hit the streets of several cities to call for better working conditions. Rallies were held in Paris, Bordeaux, Nantes, Rennes, and Montpellier as part of some 200 events organized across the country. Eight trade unions had joined forces to call for the protests in a sign of solidarity with workers. The protesters are angry at the stagnation of salaries, the rise in the cost of living, and a change in the unemployment benefit system. They say that workers should not have to carry the weight of the COVID crisis. Among those who joined the protests were so-called second-line workers, such as cashiers, and they feel that they've been overlooked despite putting their health at risk to keep minimum services open.
On
the question of wages, on the question of employment, we've been making proposals to the government for months and months. And for the moment, what we see is that all those who were applauded, all those who were called the second line in particular, have still not seen their wages revalued, apart from the automatic revaluation of the minimum wage, which for the moment has no consequence on wages. Because as you know, you have to wait for negotiations for the increase to be applied in companies. So these are the main demands: wages, employment, industry, public services, the main demands with many proposals.
In some public service sectors, such as schools and transport, have also been calls to stop work. French workers have lost much of their spending power due to inflation and a protracted economic crisis exacerbated by the pandemic. The latest hike in energy prices has added to the woes and left many households struggling. And this as the recent reform to unemployment benefits will likely see the unemployed receive less money from the state. A major independent investigation has revealed that French Catholic priests have sexually abused more than 200,000 children over the past 7 decades.
In the French population aged over 18 years old, 216,000 people, plus or minus 50,000 at 95% confidence interval, were sexually abused as minors by clergymen or people holding religious office.
The president of the commission also called the abuses systematic, adding that a number of the victims could go up to 330,000 if lower church hierarchies, such as teachers, are included. He accused the church establishment of showing deep, total, and cruel indifference for years to protect itself rather than the victims. Swaife said that the church sometimes knowingly put children in touch with predators. He also revealed that a majority of those who were sexually assaulted as minors are still alive. The independent commission was set up in 2018 in response to a series of sexual abuse scandals that shook the Catholic Church in France and worldwide. A Facebook whistleblower and former employee has gone before U.S. lawmakers to push them to regulate the social media giant.
But I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy. The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people. Congressional action is needed. They won't solve this crisis without your help.
Now, Haugen made the remarks while testifying on Capitol Hill after she leaked internal documents to authorities in the Wall Street Journal. She said that Facebook is aware how drug cartels and human traffickers use its services openly, but has done nothing to stop them. She added that the company deliberately conceals crucial information from the public and governments. Haugen accused the social media giant of keeping its algorithms a secret, demanding transparency about its operations. She described Facebook as an urgent threat to the U.S. This is a day after Facebook, its photo sharing app Instagram, and messaging service WhatsApp went offline for 7 hours, impacting billions of users globally. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Imam Hassan's political perspective. In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. Today, the 28th of the month of Safar, is a day of double grief. In the Prophet of Islam passed away on this day in 11 AH. His elder grandson was martyred through poisoning on this same day, 39 years later in 50 AH. Here we present you a special feature on Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, and his political perspective. Stay with us, please. Hassan and Hussein are imams, divinely designated leaders, whether they siege, make peace, or rise with the sword against deviation. This statement from no less a personality than the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind, with the universal message of Islam, is proof of the unrivaled merits of his two grandsons, whom he also hailed as leaders of the youth of paradise. These merits of the two brothers, who salvaged Islam into different ways within a period of 20 years in accordance with the political conditions of their times against two avowed enemies of the mission of the grandfather, the Prophet of Islam, having contrasting approaches to deceive and destroy Muslims, are mentioned in all books of hadith and history of both the Sunni and Shia Muslims. If in 41 AH Imam Hassan, peace upon him, had to resort to the masterstroke of truce to unmask the hypocrisy of the Umayyad rebel of Ibn Abu Sufyan by relinquishing the caliphate, a political rule that was worthless when compared to his spiritual authority as the divinely designated leader of mankind, his younger brother Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in his own capacity as God's representative on earth, had to court martyrdom on the battlefield in 61 AH along with his sons, brothers, nephews, cousins, and loyal companions to expose Yazid ibn Muawiyah as a heathen with not even remotest connection to Islam. In other words, in the same manner that Imam Hussein, peace upon him, had given his support to his elder brother's decision to kick the caliphate away in order to uncover Muawiyah as a crafty criminal, undermining Islam by masquerading as a Muslim, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, if he had been alive to see the accursed Yazid seizing the reins of caliphate, he would have adopted his younger brother's tactics to rise against the godless despot and court-martyr them on the battlefield in order to save Islam and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. To be more precise, the mission of a divinely designated leader is to preserve the genuine teachings of the Prophet in the face of apostasy, hypocrisy, distortion, and deviation by means of political prudence and as per the changing circumstances, as was shown by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. In 11 AH, his right of political leadership, which was so clearly specified by the Prophet of Islam on 18th of Dhul-Hajjah 10 AH at Qadir Khum, was usurped by a group of neo-Muslims. Imam Ali, peace upon him, the person who had single-handedly won many a crucial battle, didn't unsheathe his sword, but allowed the caliphs to continue the rule of the Islamic State out of concern that an armed encounter would make the majority of the Arabs revert to paganism, and, in addition, would indicate that he was thirsty for power at all costs. Yet a quarter century later, when the caliphate came begging at his doorstep, and Imam Ali, peace upon him, reluctantly assumed political power, he didn't sit quiet against the oath breakers, seditionists, and renegades. He crushed their rebellions on the battlefields of Jamal, Safin, and Nahrawan for the sake of preserving Muslim unity and the teachings of his prophet, even if it meant he would be martyred. Thus, as the divinely designated heirs to their immaculate father, both Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them, for the sake of Islam, adopted prudent policies, irrespective of the loss of the caliphate for the elder brother or the loss of life for the younger brother. Since today is the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, in 58, it will not be out of context to focus briefly on his political perspectives, which he brilliantly outlined in one of his sermons, saying, "Politics means observing the rights of God and the rights of the living, and the rights of the dead. The rights of God mean that you should obey his orders and avoid what he forbids. The rights of the living mean that you should observe your duty to your brethren and not tarry in serving your people. You should be faithful to the one in legitimate authority among you as long as he is faithful to the people. You should speak up in his face should he deviate from the right path. The rights of the dead mean that you should remember their good deeds and overlook their bad ones. They have a Lord who shall ask them about whatever they did." Following the martyrdom of Imam Ali, peace upon him, on the 21st of Ramadan, 48, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, was acknowledged by the masses as the caliph of a realm that stretched from North Africa to the borders of China in Central Asia and which is now made up of at least 20 countries. It was a vast realm whose western parts were being gradually seized by the bloody thirst for political power of Muawiyah and his comrade in crimes against Islam, Amr ibn As. Imam Hassan, peace upon him, showed his political astuteness by mobilizing a force of 40,000 and marching to meet the enemy. When, however, he found that the satanic stratagem of Muawiyah, whose wanton killing and pillaging of Muslims, coupled with pretensions for peace, had weakened the faith of the Iraqis and made them lose the stomach to fight deviation, he decided to relinquish the caliphate, but on certain conditions in order to expose falsehood in its true colors. In addition to the hypocrites within his own ranks, who at least twice attempt to assassinate him, and the treason of his military commander Ubaydullah ibn Abbas, who deserted and demoralized the 12,000 army sent by Imam against the Syrians by crossing over to the side of Muawiyah being bribed, He was also aware of the fact that Emperor Constantine of Byzantine or the Eastern Roman Empire was closely watching events in the Islamic world. The Christian power was looking for an opportunity to seize Beit al-Muqaddas by taking advantage of the intended civil war of Muawiyah, who was a pagan at heart and a reluctant convert to Islam as late as 88, at the peaceful surrender of Mecca to Muslims some 2 years before the Prophet passed away. Thus, the fall of Palestine to the Byzantines would have forced the people of Syria and even of Egypt, both of whom were new converts to Islam, to return to Christianity and place their countries again under Roman rule. This is further proof of the political foresight of Imam Hassan, peace upon him, his God-given spiritual powers that no political usurper could seize nor any traitor could harm, deemed it prudent to give up political power in order to save Islam and Muslims from both Umayyad hypocrisy and European hegemony. Moreover, like his father, he had neither attachment to worldly rule as power-hungry and unprincipled politicians have, nor could he be heedless of the Prophet's needs and sufferings as a result of unnecessary spilling of blood in an atmosphere where beliefs were still confounded because of the sedition wrought at Saqif Bani Sa'de no sooner had his grandfather left the world. Thus, on 26th of Rabiul Awwal 41 AH, after 6 months as caliph, he took the politically prudent step of concluding a treaty with Muawiyah that was as decisive as the Prophet's treaty of Hudaybiyah with the Meccan infidels, which God has hailed as Fathul Mubin, meaning manifest victory in the Noble Quran. It is worth recalling here that at Hudaybiyah in 78, while the four-year-old Imam Hassan, peace upon him, was endeared by Muslims as Rayhanat al-Rasul or Bezel of the Prophet, the 27-year-old Muawiyah was still a pagan and an open enemy of Islam, along with his equally accursed parents, Abu Sufyan and Hind, who had tried to chew the ripped-off liver of the Prophet's uncle Hamza after having martyred him at the Battle of Uhud. Among the stipulations of the treaty was that Muawiyah should rule according to the Book of God and the Sunnah of the Prophet. He should stop his pagan practice of insulting the name of Imam Ali, peace upon him. He should not shed Muslim blood in pursuit of his political ambitions. He has no right to nominate any successor. The caliphate should return to Imam Hassan, peace upon him, after him, and the revenues of the district of Darabgard near Shiraz are assigned for the upkeep of the families of those who attain martyrdom in the battles imposed upon Imam Ali, peace upon him. In his greed for the caliphate, the avaricious Muawiyah agreed to the terms of the treaty, but soon, to the horror of the deceived Iraqis, he breached each and every of its clauses. He told them that from now on, it is the swords of the Syrians and their necks if they were to oppose Umayyad policies. The ingrates had learned it the hard way not to trust the occupiers and the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt. For his part, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, relinquished the caliphate and retired to Medina to carry on the mission of his grandfather, while the usurper Muawiyah broke all commitments to the clauses of the treaty. He transgressed the rights of God through sins in public, violated the rights of the dead Muslims whose image he tried to tarnish by reviling their blessed memory, including that of Imam Ali, peace upon him, suppressed the rights of the living by killing and tyrannically exploiting them. Had Imam Hassan, peace upon him, fatally poisoned and towards the end of his long rule imposed his libertine son Yazid as heir, a most abominable crime in the history that was defeated at Karbala by Imam Hussein, peace upon him, who sacrificed his life to salvage Islam in 61 AH. On the 28th of Safar in 50 AH, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, departed from the world as a martyr, and being fatally poisoned by an agent of Muawiyah, whose forces in Medina riddled the coffin and corpse of the Prophet's elder grandson with arrows before he was laid to rest in Baqi Cemetery. Alas, in 1925, the Saudi seditionists, on seizing Medina, desecrated the sacred Baqi Cemetery and destroyed the magnificent mausoleum housing the tomb of Imam Hassan, his nephew Imam Zain al-Abidin, his maternal grandson Imam Muhammad Baqir, and the latter son Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon them.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about Nazr, or giving food and charity to the poor and the like, according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Of it, you know, giving nazr and donation and charity is a common practice in many places, sure, especially among Muslims. A lot of women also give food and charity to the poor, all right? Yeah. In every month, sometimes, or even especially in the month of Muharram or in the month of Safar. This is done not only to commemorate these months, and the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, but also to earn rewards and sabab, right?
Yeah.
So I want to ask you this question. Is it permissible for a woman to give a sadaqah, a charity, alms or food to the poor, to those people who are deprived, basically, economically speaking, or financially in a bad way, or to the neighbors using her husband's money or wealth without the consciousness, without the awareness of the husband?
Mm-hmm. Good.
All right? So is it permissible?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I would like to clarify the meaning of nazr. You know, we use the word nazr very often.
Mm-hmm.
And this word is used in different countries and different Shia communities. Of course, when it comes to the Persian or, let's say, Indian Shia community, of course, the word nazr means giving food to the poor or to the neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, nazr, speaking from a legal perspective or from a juridical perspective,
yes,
I think first of all we need to know what nazr means, and what is the exact word we can use in place of nazr. See, I think the best word to use is the word vow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And now let's define vow. Okay.
Right.
Vow means making it obligatory upon oneself.
Right.
To do something, or to do something, or a good act, or to refrain from doing an act which is better not to do, or which is haram to do, okay, for the sake of God, or for the pleasure of Allah. So, the point is that vow means to make a good act obligatory upon oneself, okay?
Yes.
This is what jurists understand from the word nazr and the word vow, okay?
It's a kind of promise, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a kind of promise. And let's use the word vow, because promise may be mistaken for ahad, for, let's say, some other
It's much more general and broad.
Yeah, it's more general and more
broad.
Yeah, inclusive.
Yes.
And of course, we have there's another word which is which we may use the word covenant, but that's another word completely different.
True.
And surely.
Yes.
So Nazr used in by let's say by the Persian community or people who, especially ladies, who give food handout to people. And to the poor, that's a kind of mustahab charity given by women or by people to the poor or to the neighbors. Okay, and we of course can talk about that as well in this episode or in the following episodes.
Yes.
Anyhow, when it comes to your question, you just said whether it is you asked whether it's permissible or not for a woman to give food or charity or something of monetary value to the poor, or to the needy, and to the neighbors, okay, for earning sawab, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's very important, it's very recommended, highly recommended to give charity, to give food or money to the needy, because the Quran says, وَانْفِقُوا مِمَّا تُحِبُّونَ, okay, you have to give charity from what you like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like money, I like my wealth, I like whatever I have saved in my life, and anything which is of monetary value is what I like.
Yes.
Okay, so it's good and recommended according to fiqh, according to the Quran and Islamic teachings, to give something in charity. But when it comes to a woman using her husband's property, wealth, or asset, or whatever, and savings to give charity, of course, there's no doubt as to the fact that she must get her husband's consent and permission. Explicit consent is important, of course. And without his consent, of course, it's not permissible to give charity or to make a vow. You know?
Okay.
That vow can be nullified by the husband. Okay, if the husband opposes the wife and tells, okay, you cannot do nazr because I need you, for example, you must be available for me. Okay, she cannot do nazr. Even if it is an obligatory nazr, that nazr is not going to be binding.
Okay.
It's not going to be obligatory to comply with.
I see. Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be back and discuss more of these laws.
Sure.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about vows or nazr, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. If, Sheikh Javid, a person pledges a vow that he will do something, but he cannot or he does not recite the formula of the vow or nazr. All right? Is it still necessary that he fulfill the promise?
Mm.
Is just making the intention of the vow sufficient or adequate?
First of all, from what you just said, I understand that it is basically there is a formula that one has to recite.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what you your question implies, and of course a formula is required. Okay.
Yes.
And without a formula, the nazr is not going to be binding. Okay. Now, when it comes to reciting the formula, of course, the nazr or the vow becomes actually obligatory and binding when, in fact, the person who wants to make that vow or pledges a vow actually does recite the formula.
Right.
And if he just makes the intention or passes his intention through his mind without uttering anything,
mm-hmm.
so it will not be obligatory to comply with that intention.
Uh-huh.
Okay. He has to say something. He has to recite it verbally, recite the formula verbally. And it's not, the formula means there is a standard saying.
Mm-hmm.
There is a saying which one has to recite if he is willing or if he's planning to make a vow. And that formula must convey an explicit meaning, okay? The formula is a standard formula. It is okay. It begins, for example, if you want to recite the formula in Arabic, you have to recite, for example, لِلَّهِ عَلَيَّ أَنْ أَسُومُ or لِلَّهِ عَلَيَّ أَنْ أُصَلِّي. For example, it's from Allah upon me to, for example, offer prayer or observe fast. And then the vow that you make should be fixed, and of course it should be clear enough. Okay, clear. You can make a vague vow. Mm-hmm. Okay,
yes.
But in that case, if you make a vague vow and without fixing the time, without fixing the quality or the attributes of that vow, it will be binding, but it's not necessary to comply with the vow immediately. You can delay
it. You can leave it open-ended.
Yeah, you can do it anytime.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun la ilaha illa hum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun latifun tawwabun samiun basir
of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.